Chapter 18. A Question is Answered.
"The Earthman is mad!" cried Liebig, turning to the others. "Isn't that obvious?"
Some stared at Liebig wordlessly, some at Bailey. Bailey gave them no chance to come to decisions. He said,
"You know better, Dr. Liebig. Dr. Delmar was going to break off with you. Mrs. Delmar thought it was because you wouldn't marry.
I don't think so. Dr. Delmar himself was planning a future in which ectogenesis would be possible and marriage unnecessary. But Dr. Delmar was working with you. He would know and guess more about your work than anyone else. He would know if you were attempting dangerous experiments, and he would try to stop you. He hinted about such matters to Agent Gruer, but gave no details because he was not yet certain of the details. Obviously, you discovered his suspicions and killed him."
"Mad!"
said Liebig again.
"I will have nothing more to do with this."
But Adelbisch interrupted.
"Hear him out, Liebig."
Bailey bit his lip to keep from a premature display of satisfaction at the obvious lack of sympathy in the security head's voice. He said,
"In the same discussion with me in which you mentioned robots with detachable limbs, Dr. Liebig, you mentioned spaceships with built-in positronic brains. You were definitely talking too much then. Was it that you thought I was only an Earthman and incapable of understanding the implications of robotics? Or was it that you had just been threatened with personal presence, had the threat lifted, and were a little delirious with relief? In any case, Dr. Quimmott had already told me that the secret weapon of Solaria against the Outer Worlds was the positronic robot."
Quimmott, thus unexpectedly referred to, started violently and cried,
"I meant—" "You meant it sociologically, I know, but it gives rise to thoughts. Consider a spaceship with a built-in positronic brain as compared to a manned spaceship. A manned spaceship could not use robots in active warfare. A robot could not destroy humans on enemy spaceships or on enemy worlds. It could not grasp the distinction between friendly humans and enemy humans. Of course, a robot could be told that the opposing spaceship had no humans aboard. It could be told that it was an uninhabited planet that was being bombarded. That would be difficult to manage. A robot could see that its own ship carried humans. It would know its own world held humans. It would assume that the same was true of enemy ships and worlds. It would take a real expert in robotics, such as you, Dr. Liebig, to handle them properly in that case, and there are very few such experts. But a spaceship that was equipped with its own positronic brain would cheerfully attack any ship it was directed to attack, it seems to me. It would naturally assume all other ships were unmanned. A positronic-brained ship could easily be made incapable of receiving messages from enemy ships that might undeceive it. With its weapons and defenses under the immediate control of a positronic brain, it would be more maneuverable than any manned ship. With no room necessary for crewmen, for supplies, for water or air purifiers, it could carry more armor, more weapons, and be more invulnerable than any ordinary ship. One ship with a positronic brain could defeat fleets of ordinary ships. Am I wrong?" The last question was shot at Dr. Liebig, who had risen from his seat and was standing, rigid, almost cataleptic, with what? Anger? Horror? There was no answer. No answer could have been heard. Something tore loose and the others were yelling madly. Clarissa had the face of a fury. And even Gladiah was on her feet, her small fist beating the air threateningly. And all had turned on Liebig. Bailey relaxed and closed his eyes. He tried for just a few moments to unknot his muscles, unfreeze his tendons. It had worked. He had pressed the right button at last. Quimmott had made an analogy between the Solarian robots and the Spartan helots. He said the robots could not revolt so that the Solarians could relax. But what if some human threatened to teach the robots how to harm humans, to make them, in other words, capable of revolting? Would that not be the ultimate crime? On a world such as Solaria, would not every last inhabitant turn fiercely against anyone even suspected of making a robot capable of harming a human? On Solaria, where robots outnumbered humans by 20,000 to 1. Adelbisch cried,
"You are under arrest. You are absolutely forbidden to touch your books or records until the government has a chance to inspect them."
He went on, almost incoherent, scarcely heard in the pandemonium. A robot approached Bailey.
"A message, Master, from the Master Oliver."
Bailey took the message gravely, turned and cried,
"One moment."
His voice had an almost magical effect. All turned to look at him solemnly, and in no face, outside Liebig's frozen glare, was there any sign of anything but the most painful attention to the Earthman.
Bailey said, "It is foolish to expect Dr. Liebig to leave his records untouched while waiting for some official to reach them. So even before this interview began, my partner, Daniil Oliver, left for Dr. Liebig's estate. I have just heard from him. He is on the grounds now and will be with Dr. Liebig in a moment, in order that he may be put under restraint."
"Restrained?"
howled Liebig in an almost animal terror. His eyes widened into staring holes in his head.
"Someone coming here? Personal presence? No! No!"
The second no was a shriek.
"You will not be harmed," said Bailey coldly, "if you cooperate."
"But I won't see him. I can't see him."
The roboticist fell to his knees without seeming aware of the motion. He put his hands together in a desperate, clasped gesture of appeal.
"What do you want? Do you want a confession? Delmar's robot had detachable limbs. Yes, yes, yes. I arranged Gruer's poisoning. I arranged the arrow meant for you. I even planned the spaceships, as you said. I haven't succeeded, but yes, I planned it. Only keep the man away. Don't let him come. Keep him away."
He was babbling.
Bailey nodded. Another right button.
The threat of personal presence would do more to induce confession than any physical torture. But then, at some noise or movement outside the field of sound or vision of any of the others, Liebig's head twisted and his mouth opened. He lifted a pair of hands, holding something off.
"Away!"
he begged.
"Go away! Don't come! Please don't come! Please!"
He scrambled away on hands and knees. Then his hand went suddenly to a pocket in his jacket. It came out with something and moved rapidly to his mouth. Swaying twice, he fell prone. Bailey wanted to cry, "You fool, it isn't a human that's approaching. Only one of the robots you love." Daniil Oliver darted into the field of vision and for a moment stared down at the crumpled figure. Bailey held his breath. If Daniil should realize it was his own pseudo-humanity that had killed Liebig, the effect on his first law-enslaved brain might be drastic. But Daniil only knelt, and his delicate fingers touched Liebig here and there. Then he lifted Liebig's head, as though it were infinitely precious to him, cradling it, caressing it. His beautifully chiseled face stared out at the others, and he whispered,
"A human is dead."
Bailey was expecting her. She had asked for a last interview, but his eyes widened when she appeared. He said,
"I'm seeing you."
"Yes," said Gladia. "How can you tell?"
"You're wearing gloves."
"Oh."
She looked at her hands in confusion. Then, softly,
"Do you mind?"
"No, of course not. But why have you decided to see rather than view?"
"Well,"
she smiled weakly,
"I've got to get used to it, don't I, Elijah? I mean, if I'm going to Aurora."
"Then it's all arranged?"
"Mr. Oliver seems to have influence. It's all arranged. I'll never come back."
"Good. You'll be happier, Gladia. I know you will."
"I'm a little afraid."
"I know. It will mean seeing all the time, and you won't have all the comforts you had on Solaria. But you'll get used to it. And what's more, you'll forget all the terror you've been through."
"I don't want to forget everything," said Gladia softly.
"You will."
Bailey looked at the slim girl who stood before him and said, not without a momentary pang, "And you will be married someday, too. Really married, I mean."
"Somehow," she said mournfully, "that doesn't seem so attractive to me right now."
"You'll change your mind." And they stood there, looking at each other for a wordless moment. Gladia said,
"I've never thanked you."
Bailey said, "It was only my job."
"You'll be going back to Earth now, won't you?"
"Yes."
"I'll never see you again."
"Probably not. But don't feel badly about that. In 40 years at most, I'll be dead, and you won't look a bit different from the way you do now." Her face twisted.
"Don't say that."
"It's true." She said rapidly, as though forced to change the subject,
"It's all true about Jothan Liebig, you know."
"I know. Other roboticists went over his records and found experiments toward unmanned intelligent spaceships. They also found other robots with replaceable limbs." Gladia shuddered.
"Why did he do such a horrible thing, do you suppose?"
"He was afraid of people. He killed himself to avoid personal presence, and he was ready to kill other worlds to make sure that Solaria and its personal presence taboo would never be touched."
"How could he feel so?" she murmured. "When personal presence can be so very..."
Again a silent moment while they faced each other at 10 paces. Then Gladia cried suddenly,
"Oh, Elijah, you'll think it abandoned of me."
"Think what abandoned?"
"May I touch you? I'll never see you again, Elijah."
"If you want to." Step by step, she came closer, her eyes glowing, yet looking apprehensive too. She stopped 3 feet away, then slowly, as though in a trance, she began to remove the glove on her right hand. Bailey started a restraining gesture.
"Don't be foolish, Gladia."
"I'm not afraid,"
said Gladia. Her hand was bare. It trembled as she extended it. And so did Bailey's as he took her hand in his. They remained so for one moment, her hand a shy thing, frightened as it rested in his. He opened his hand, and hers escaped, darted suddenly and without warning toward his face, until her fingertips rested feather light upon his cheek for the barest moment. She said,
"Thank you, Elijah. Goodbye."
He said, "Goodbye, Gladia," and watched her leave. Even the thought that a ship was waiting to take him back to Earth did not wipe out the sense of loss he felt at that moment. Undersecretary Albert Minim's look was intended to be one of prim welcome.
"I'm glad to see you back on Earth. Your report, of course, arrived before you did and is being studied. You did a good job. The matter will look well in your record."
"Thank you," said Bailey. There was no room for further elation in him. Being back on Earth, being safe in the caves, being in hearing of Jessie's voice, he had spoken to her already, had left him strangely empty.
"However," said Minim, "your report concerned only the murder investigation. There was another matter we were interested in. May I have a report on that, verbally?"
Bailey hesitated, and his hand moved automatically toward the inner pocket where the warm comfort of his pipe could once more be found. Minim said at once,
"You may smoke, Bailey."
Bailey made of the lighting process a rather drawn-out ritual. He said, "I am not a sociologist."
"Aren't you?"
Minim smiled briefly.
"It seems to me we discussed that once. A successful detective must be a good rule-of-thumb sociologist, even if he never heard of Hackett's equation. I think from your discomfort at the moment that you have notions concerning the outer worlds, but aren't sure how it will sound to me."
If you put it that way, sir. When you ordered me to Solaria, you asked a question. You asked what the weaknesses of the outer worlds were. Their strengths were their robots, their low population, their long lives. But what were their weaknesses? Well, I believe I know the weaknesses of the Solarian, sir.
You can answer my question?
Good. Go ahead. Their weaknesses, sir, are their robots, their low population, their long lives.
Minim stared at Bailey without any change of expression. His hands worked in jerky, finger-drawn designs along the papers on his desk. He said,
"Why do you say that?"
Bailey had spent hours organizing his thoughts on the way back from Solaria, had confronted officialdom in imagination with balanced, well-reasoned arguments. Now he felt at a loss. He said,
"I'm not sure I can put them clearly. No matter, let me hear. This is first approximation only."
Bailey said,
"The Solarians have given up something mankind has had for a million years. Something worth more than atomic power, cities, agriculture, tools, fire, everything. Because it's something that made everything else possible."
"I don't want to guess, Bailey. What is it?"
"The tribe, sir. Cooperation between individuals. Solaria has given it up entirely. It is a world of isolated individuals, and the planet's only sociologist is delighted that this is so." That sociologist, by the way, never heard of sociomathematics because he is inventing his own science. There is no one to teach him, no one to help him, no one to think of something he himself might miss. The only science that really flourishes on Solaria is robotics, and there are only a handful of men involved in that. And when it came to an analysis of the interaction of robots and men, they had to call in an Earthman to help. Solarian art, sir, is abstract. We have abstract art on Earth as one form of art, but on Solaria, it is the only form. The human touch is gone. The looked-for future is one of ectogenesis and complete isolation from birth."
Minim said,
"It all sounds horrible, but is it harmful?"
"I think so. Without the interplay of human against human, the chief interest in life is gone. Most of the intellectual values are gone. Most of the reason for living is gone. Viewing is no substitute for seeing. The Solarians themselves are conscious that viewing is a long-distance sense. And if isolation isn't enough to induce stagnation, there is the matter of their long lives. On Earth, we have a continuous influx of young people who are willing to change because they haven't had time to grow hard-set in their ways. I suppose there's some optimum. A life long enough for a real accomplishment and short enough to make way for youth at a rate that's not too slow. On Solaria, the rate is too slow."
Minim still drew patterns with his finger.
"Interesting. Interesting."
He looked up, and it was as though a mask had fallen away. There was glee in his eyes.
"Plainclothesman, you're a man of penetration."
"Thank you,"
said Bailey stiffly.
"Do you know why I encouraged you to describe your views to me?"
He was almost like a little boy hugging his pleasure. He went on without waiting for an answer.
"Your report has already undergone preliminary analysis by our sociologists, and I was wondering if you had any idea yourself as to the excellent news for Earth you had brought with you."
"I see you have."
"But wait," said Bailey. "There's more to this."
"Oh, there is indeed,"
agreed Minim jubilantly.
"Solaria cannot possibly correct its stagnation. It has passed a critical point, and their dependence on robots has gone too far. Individual robots can't discipline an individual child, even though discipline may do the child eventual good. The robot can't see past the immediate pain, and robots collectively cannot discipline a planet by allowing its institutions to collapse when the institutions have grown harmful. They can't see past the immediate chaos. So the only end for the outer worlds is perpetual stagnation, and Earth will be freed of their domination. Oh, this new data changes everything. Physical revolt will not even be necessary. Freedom will come of itself."
"Wait,"
said Bailey again, more loudly.
It's only Solaria we're discussing, not any other outer world.
It's the same thing. You're Solarian sociologist Kimmet Quimmet, sir.
Quimmet, then.
He said, did he not, that the other outer worlds were moving in the direction of Solaria?
He did, but he knew nothing about the other outer worlds firsthand, and he was no sociologist. Not really. I thought I made that clear.
Our own men will check. They'll lack data, too.
We know nothing about the really big outer worlds. Aurora, for instance. Daniil's world. To me, it doesn't seem reasonable to expect them to be anything like Solaria. In fact, there's only one world in the galaxy which resembles Solaria.
Minim was dismissing the subject with a small, happy wave of his neat hand.
Our men will check. I'm sure they will agree with Quimmet.
Bailey's stare grew somber. If Earth's sociologists were anxious enough for happy news, they would find themselves agreeing with Quimmet at that. Anything could be found in figures if the search were long enough and hard enough, and if the proper pieces of information were ignored or overlooked. He hesitated. Was it best now to speak while he had the ear of a man high in the government, or... He hesitated a trifle too long. Minim was speaking again, shuffling a few papers and growing more matter-of-fact.
A few minor matters, plainclothesman, concerning the Delmar case itself, and then you will be free to go. Did you intend to have Liebig commit suicide?
I intended to force a confession, sir. I had not anticipated suicide at the approach, ironically, of someone who was only a robot, and who would not really be violating the taboo against personal presence. But frankly, I don't regret his death. He was a dangerous man. It will be a long time before there will be another man who will combine his sickness and his brilliance.
I agree with that, said Minim dryly,
and consider his death fortunate. But didn't you consider your danger if the Solarians had stopped to realize that Liebig couldn't possibly have murdered Delmar?
Bailey took his pipe out of his mouth and said nothing.
Come, plainclothesman, said Minim.
You know he didn't. The murder required personal presence, and Liebig would die rather than allow that.
He did die rather than allow it.
Bailey said,
You're right, sir. I counted on the Solarians being too horrified at his misuse of robots to stop to think of that.
Then who did kill Delmar?
Bailey said slowly, If you mean who struck the actual blow, it was the person everyone knew had done so. Gladiah Delmar, the man's wife.
And you let her go?
Bailey said, Morally, the responsibility wasn't hers. Liebig knew Gladiah quarreled bitterly with her husband, and often. He must have known how furious she could grow in moments of anger. Liebig wanted the death of the husband under circumstances that would incriminate the wife. So he supplied Delmar with a robot and, I imagine, instructed it with all the skill he possessed to hand Gladiah one of its detachable limbs at the moment of her full fury. With a weapon in her hand at the crucial moment, she acted in a temporary blackout before either Delmar or the robot could stop her. Gladiah was as much Liebig's unwitting instrument as the robot itself. Minim said,
The robot's arm must have been smeared with blood and matted hair.
It probably was, said Bailey. But it was Liebig who took the murder robot in charge. He could easily have instructed any other robots who might have noticed the fact to forget it. Dr. Thule might have noticed it, but he inspected only the dead man and the unconscious woman. Liebig's mistake was to think that guilt would rest so obviously on Gladiah that the matter of the absence of an obvious weapon at the scene wouldn't save her. Nor could he anticipate that an Earthman would be called in to help with the investigation.
So, with Liebig dead, you arranged to have Gladiah leave Solaria. Was that to save her in case any Solarians began thinking about the case?
Bailey shrugged. She had suffered enough. She had been victimized by everyone, by her husband, by Liebig, by the world of Solaria.
Minim said, Weren't you bending the law to suit a personal whim?
Bailey's craggy face grew hard. It was not a whim.
I was not bound by Salarian law. Earth's interests were paramount, and for the sake of those interests, I had to see that Liebig, the dangerous one, was dealt with. As for Mrs. Delmar, he faced Minim now and felt himself taking a crucial step. He had to say this. As for Mrs. Delmar, I made her the basis of an experiment. What experiment? I wanted to know if she would consent to face a world where personal presence was permitted and expected. I was curious to know if she had the courage to face disruption of habits so deeply settled in her. I was afraid she might refuse to go, that she might insist on remaining on Salaria, which was purgatory to her, rather than bring herself to abandon her distorted Salarian way of life. But she chose change, and I was glad she did, because to me it seemed symbolic. It seemed to open the gates of salvation for us.
For us? Said Minim with energy. What the devil do you mean?
Not for you and me particularly, sir, said Bailey gravely, but for all mankind. You're wrong about the other outer worlds. They have few robots. They permit personal presence, and they have been investigating Salaria. Our Daniil Oliva was there with me, you know, and he'll bring back a report. There is a danger they may become Salaria someday, but they will probably recognize that danger and work to keep themselves in a reasonable balance, and in that way remain the leaders of mankind.
That is your opinion, said Minim testily.
And there's more to it. There is one world like Salaria, and that's Earth.
Plain clothesman, Bailey.
It's so, sir. We're Salaria inside out. They retreated into isolation from one another. We retreated into isolation from the galaxy. They are at the dead end of their inviolable estates. We are at the dead end of underground cities. They're leaders without followers, only robots who can't talk back. We're followers without leaders, only enclosing cities to keep us safe. Bailey's fists clenched. Minim disapproved.
Plainclothesman, you have been through an ordeal. You need a rest, and you will have one. A month's vacation, full pay, and a promotion at the end of it.
Thank you, but that's not all I want. I want you to listen. There's only one direction out of our dead end, and that's outward, toward space. There are a million worlds out there, and the spacers own only 50. They are few and long-lived. We are many and short-lived. We are better suited than they for exploration and colonization. We have population pressure to push us and a rapid turnover of generation to keep us supplied with the young and reckless. It was our ancestors who colonized the outer worlds in the first place.
Yes, I see, but I'm afraid our time is up.
Bailey could feel the other's anxiety to be rid of him, and he remained stolidly in place. He said,
When the original colonization established worlds superior to our own in technology, we escaped by building wombs beneath the ground for ourselves. The spacers made us feel inferior, and we hid from them. That's no answer. To avoid the destructive rhythm of rebellion and suppression, we must compete with them, follow them if we must, lead them if we can. To do that, we must face the open. We must teach ourselves to face the open. If it is too late to teach ourselves, then we must teach our children. It's vital!
You need a rest, plainclothesman,
Bailey said violently.
Listen to me, sir! If the spacers are strong and we remain as we are, then Earth will be destroyed within a century. That has been computed, as you yourself told me. If the spacers are really weak and are growing weaker, then we may escape. But who says the spacers are weak?
The Salarians, yes, but that's all we know.
But I'm not through. One thing we can change, whether the spacers are weak or strong, we can change the way we are. Let us face the open, and we'll never need rebellion. We can spread out into our own crowd of worlds and become spacers ourselves. If we stay here on Earth, cooped up, then useless and fatal rebellion can't be stopped. It will be all the worse if the people build any false hopes because of supposed spacer weakness. Go ahead, ask the sociologists. Put my argument to them. And if they're still in doubt, find a way to send me to Aurora. Let me bring back a report on the real spacers, and you'll see what Earth must do. Minim nodded. Yes, yes. Good day now, plainclothesman Bailey.
Bailey left with a feeling of exultation. He had not expected an open victory over Minim. Victories over ingrained patterns of thought are not won in a day or a year. But he had seen the look of pensive uncertainty that had crossed Minim's face and had blotted out, at least for a while, the earlier uncritical joy. He felt he could see into the future. Minim would ask the sociologists, and one or two of them would be uncertain. They would wonder. They would consult Bailey. Give it 1 year, thought Bailey. 1 year, and I'll be on my way to Aurora. 1 generation, and we'll be out in space once more. Bailey stepped onto the northbound expressway. Soon he would see Jessie. Would she understand? And his son, Bentley, now 17. When Ben had a 17-year-old of his own, would he be standing on some empty world, building a spacious life? It was a frightening thought. Bailey still feared the open, but he no longer feared the fear. It was not something to run from, that fear, but something to fight. Bailey felt as though a touch of madness had come over him. From the very first, the open had had its weird attraction over him. From the time in the ground car when he had tricked Daniil in order to have the top lowered so that he might stand up in the open air. He had failed to understand then. Daniil thought he was being perverse. Bailey himself thought he was facing the open out of professional necessity to solve a crime. Only on that last evening on Solaria, with the curtain tearing away from the window, did he realize his need to face the open for the open's own sake, for its attraction and its promise of freedom. There must be millions on Earth who would feel that same urge if the open were only brought to their attention, if they could be made to take the first step. He looked about. The expressway was speeding on. All about him was artificial light and huge banks of apartments gliding backward, and flashing signs and store windows and factories and lights and noise and crowds and more noise and people and people and people. It was all he had loved, all he had hated and feared to leave, all he had thought he longed for on Solaria. And it was all strange to him. He couldn't make himself fit back in. He had gone out to solve a murder, and something had happened to him. He had told Minim the cities were wombs, and so they were. And what was the first thing a man must do before he can be a man? He must be born. He must leave the womb. And once left, it could not be re-entered. Bailey had left the city and could not re-enter. The city was no longer his. The caves of steel were alien. This had to be. And it would be so for others, and Earth would be born again and reach outward. His heart beat madly, and the noise of life about him sank to an unheard murmur. He remembered his dream on Solaria, and he understood it at last. He lifted his head, and he could see through all the steel and concrete and humanity above him. He could see the beacon set in space to lure men outward. He could see it shining down. The naked sun. This concludes The Naked Sun by Isaac Asimov. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.